Last week, on my day off, I took a trip with my mom. We went to Michigan. We've been going to Michigan. Well, I should say her family has been going to Michigan since she was five. Every summer. Same place, every summer. Okay? My first trip was when I was 6 weeks old. So we've been doing it forever, and I love it. And I helped my mom do something that I've been pushing her to do for a very long time, which was to delete the Facebook app from her phone. I deleted the app many months ago because it had become the mental and emotional equivalent of eating an entire bag of chips or snacking on the M&Ms which Eileen Gutierrez keeps supplied for the staff on my desk. Hours and hours of endless scrolling, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, is just empty calories for the brain, and it was sucking the life out of me. Part of it is only because I can watch only so many minutes of small kitten videos before I want to poke my eyes out. The other part, and quite frankly, the part that makes me the most crazy, is that those who know the least know it the loudest. And there's an awful lot on social media these days that, frankly, this is just my opinion, doesn't really belong there. It's good to connect with people. It's good to see pictures and get updates from family members who might be far away or off at school. It's a great tool for sharing our faith with friends. But it's also become the means of sowing confusion, sharing fake news, ruining reputations, venting anger and grievances against people who might not be your friend, and then they can't see what you're saying about them and they can't defend themselves. Of course, I'd be free just to delete the people that I don't agree with. We see that a lot nowadays. If you support this cause or candidate or stance or position, why don't you just unfriend me now? Like I have to do the work of your social pruning. If you're seeing this, it's because you survived the great Facebook purge. I had been waiting for the results of your Facebook purge. My life was depending on who you want to be your friend. Lucky me. So the danger of just deleting people we don't like is twofold. First of all, it gives us the mindset that other people in our lives are merely deletable, which isn't true. But second, and maybe more importantly, if we cut out ourselves from the lives of everyone we don't like or with whom we disagree, we create for ourselves ghettos of thought that I no longer engage with anybody or anything that makes me upset, that makes me think, and therefore I never grow. I never change. I never encounter something new. I never hear a different opinion and say, maybe you're right. All right. So what's the core of all of this? Everyone on planet Earth is searching for something, an idea, a position that we can invest in that will withstand the test of time. I mean, we want to believe in something that's true. We want to find the thing that's true and invest in the thing. This position is the one that will endure. This position is the one that will not run out. It's a fundamental question each one of us is asking, perhaps without knowing it. Will this or will that withstand the test of time? Is there something out there that is fundamentally and ultimately true? Modern culture tries to answer this question in the absolute easiest way possible by insisting that everything is true. That what's true for you is true for you, and that what's true for me is true for me. But anybody with a brain can see that that's not possible. It's not possible that it is objectively true that nothing is objectively true. Makes no sense. So it's a naturally human thing to seek an idea, a position, or even a person whose foundation is outside of time and thus endures throughout time and throughout history. This is a good litmus test for us. Will this withstand the test of time? Right now, much of our dialogue, the national level, the local level, in the rectory, on the street, a jewel, truth, our dialogue in politics, entertainment, news, and religion is purely emotional. Well, this is what I think and what I feel, so therefore it must be true. At least it's true for me. As a nation, our collective morality is not based on any enduring model or system, but on emotion. It's sentimental barbarianism. Agree with me or be defeated. So we have a country with 300 million people looking at each other saying, agree with me or be defeated. Basing our morality and our deepest held beliefs on just what we feel at the time will never withstand the test of time. You can see where this is going. Think of all the major players in the world's debates right now about what is moral, that is, about what we ought to be doing, and about what it means to be human. In America, we're flooded with voices claiming to be authoritative in the moral debate. There's the government, which of course is now divided more than ever. There is the family, higher education, lobbies, social interest groups. There's the evangelical Christians, the mainline Protestant Christians, atheists who have become united, different religions, and of course, the Catholic Church, who speaks in the world primarily through the lived witness of her members and in the public sphere through the Conference of Bishops. Now, because of the abuse crisis and the inevitable fallout from all of that nonsense, the church is somewhat lacking in the moral authority department, at least insofar as people recognizing the church as having a valid voice is concerned. A couple of months ago, you might remember during the big abortion debate in the House, they did a big press conference, Cardinal Supich and all the bishops, and they did this big press conference, and some guy, I don't know where he was from, but he raised his hand, he was a reporter, raised his hand, he said, Cardinal, yes? That was not a very good Supich impression, but you get the point. He said, why should we listen to you? And to be honest, that's a fair question. But when we are looking for something or someone who is able to withstand the test of time, we have to look to what, up till this point, has withstood the test of time. Out of all those voices I just mentioned, the one who has withstood the test of time more than any other is the church. The church has withstood being underground and then persecuted in the Roman Empire. It still is underground in many countries in the Middle East and in China. It's withstood the invasion of Islam into Europe and Northern Africa in the 7th century. It's withstood the reformations in Germany, Northern Europe, and England. It's withstood the test of communism, fascism, and national socialism. It has even withstood the absolute stupidity of some of its bishops, priests, deacons, and lay people who, despite their best efforts, stealing money, abusing children, corrupting pious minds, altering and watering down theology to better fit the ways of the time, were not able to destroy the church. Why? Why has the church withstood the test of time? Well, we have to look at what has sustained her through the test of time, and that is her faith. Perhaps never again, never before, have we come here with such an awareness that our own strength cannot make lasting the beautiful things that happen to us in life. And maybe never before as today have we been so aware of how deeply we need someone in whom we can believe, on whom we can depend, who withstands the test of time, who responds to our endless need for duration. So listen again to part of the second reading. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. He went out, not knowing where to go. By faith, he sojourned in the promised land as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and maker is God. By faith he received power to generate, even though he was old and Sarah was sterile. And so it was that there came forth from one man, himself as good as dead, descendants as numerous as the stars of the sky, and as countless as the sands on the seashore. All of these died in faith. They did not receive what had been promised, but saw it and greeted it from afar, and acknowledged themselves to be strangers on earth. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them, a homeland, a heavenly one. Isn't that beautiful? They did not receive what had been promised, but saw it and greeted it from afar, and acknowledged that they were strangers, sojourners on the earth. Saint Therese famously said that for the Christian, the world is thy ship, not thy homeland. So any effort to plant ourselves here, to transfer our identities from children of the Father and children of the Church to a child of this cause or that candidate or that idea, these things which will not withstand the test of time, or to believe that somehow we are responsible for creating out of nothing the things that will withstand the test of time. Any effort to do this is a futile effort that will only lead us searching and yearning for more. More scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. We go to great lengths to make the kingdom of the earth a perfect one, a happy place, a just place. And there's nothing wrong with that. We have to make it a just place if we're going to live together here. But is justice on earth all we want? Are we expending all this time and money and effort merely for earthly perfection and happiness, which we are well assured will one day pass away? Why are we working like this, as if the future depends only on us? When in the gospel today, Jesus comes right out and says, "Chill out, children. The Father is pleased to give you the kingdom. He is pleased to just give you the kingdom." We out here working and sweating and fretting and being led right away from the peace and joy of God's face and presence, while the Father is like, "Dudes, dames, chill out, please. I'm literally just going to give you what you're looking for if you will let me." But how? How do we receive this thing for which we long, the thing which will withstand the test of time? Well, gird your loins, brothers and sisters, and light those lamps, and get ready for the Master who is coming to you. Challenge yourself to ask the questions about the faith that you don't know. Don't assume that you won't like the answer and then never ask the question, and then go on complaining that the Church teaches something you don't like. We have to investigate it. Look into it. Understanding things in the light of the faith directs our hearts to the worship of God and to the love of neighbor. A few suggestions. Read the readings before you come to Mass. Pray with them. Know what intention you're going to bring in here. Why are you offering Mass today? For yourself, for your family, for someone you love, for someone who's asked you to pray for them? What is your purpose in being here today? Yes, to worship Almighty God. Yes, to receive Him. But what sacrifice are you offering? In the old days, you might remember, if you were alive in the first century, it would be you who brought from your fields, from your homes, the bread and wine. And you would bring it up, and it would be your sacrifice. So what are you offering on the altar that's uniquely yours? Delete Facebook from your phone. Okay. Delete ESPN from your phone, or whatever the app is that you spend the most time on, and is it feeding you with something besides empty calories? Then just delete it, because you're more powerful than the stupid machine in your hand. So take the control back. Do one thing to feed your human soul every week. Go to a park, watch the sunset. Go to a museum, go to a concert. Eat out at a restaurant whose food you can't pronounce. Have the kids design a bucket that everybody puts their cell phones in while you're at the dinner table. The sentimental barbarianism must come to an end, because a way of life as a people, especially as a people like us who are traveling together toward the kingdom, a way of life as a people that is based on whims and whirls of our emotion will never lead us anywhere except where we began, which is chaos and disorder. So let us instead seek the one who will withstand the test of time, the one who teaches us through his Church what it means to long for, to journey, to struggle toward what is true, and then let's ask for the grace to endure, to adhere to what withstands the test of time. Jesus, through his Church, gives us a method for challenging the world and verifying his own promise to us. So remain in him and deepen that relationship with him, and you will realize that you are living in a way that has no comparison, because you are living a life that withstands the test of time.